Welcome to the Brain Bag Podcast. My name is Andrew Gunawala. Today, I am honored and delighted to welcome back, after 3 years, a former Secretary, Leon Panetta. Secretary Panetta served as our Secretary of Defense, Director of the CIA, the White House Chief of Staff, the Director of the Office of Management and Budget, and as a U.S. representative from my home state, California. Secretary Panetta has had a decades-long career, has a lot of great expertise, and today we'll be having a wide-ranging interview covering topics like Israel-Gaza, the war in Ukraine, a little bit about Taiwan, and other sort of key flashpoints in national security in 2024. So, Secretary Panetta, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Andre, it's good to be with you. We've had the opportunity to do this once before, and I look forward to this session as well.
Thank you. So, Secretary Panetta, the probably the hottest topic right now for a lot of folks, especially a lot of young professionals in foreign policy and national security, the Israel-Gaza war. Mr. Secretary, what's your take on the current state of the war?
My sense right now is that the war is in kind of a standoff situation in which nobody is really quite sure what the next step is going to be. And it can go in several directions. Obviously, the direction that a lot of us would hope for is that ultimately they could agree to some kind of prolonged ceasefire and be able to do a hostage exchange. And provide the humanitarian aid that's necessary to deal with those that have been impacted. The chances of that happening right now are obviously a lot more difficult. Even the CIA director said that this is going to be difficult to put into place. He's hoping for some kind of short-term ceasefire. But right now, we're not sure. Secondly, absent a ceasefire, Netanyahu is threatened to go into Rafah and, basically complete the devastation of Gaza in the hopes of being able to go after the Hamas leaders that may or may not be there. If that happens, again, I think a lot of people would die. A lot of innocent people would die. And I'm not sure where that takes you because, frankly, I think ultimately, even though Netanyahu keeps talking about destroying Hamas, the reality is he's not going to destroy Hamas. Hamas is going to be around for a long time. But what you can go after are the leaders of Hamas who basically led what happened on October 7th and continue to make sure that they're not around. Similar to what we did after 9/11 in going after al-Qaeda leadership. But that's going to take time. I mean, if in fact you really are just targeting the leadership, the likelihood is that that could take a prolonged period of time. But the Israelis are pretty good at that kind of thing, and I think it's the one way that they could ensure that what happened on October 7th will never happen again. So, right now it's not clear what direction we're going in. I think there's likely to be more turmoil. I mean, the United States now has basically decided to build a pier in Gaza and try to provide humanitarian aid regardless of what Israel does or doesn't do. And I think that's probably an important step just to make sure that relief is provided to the people that have been hurt. But I'm not sure where ultimately all of this winds up, because the key, as far as I'm concerned, is whether or not ultimately you really can develop a Palestinian state and provide the right leadership for that state and provide the right security for that state. That's very hopeful. I know it's tough. I know how the challenges that are involved with that. But I think ultimately that's the only way to make sure that in the Middle East, we are not facing constant war every few years.
And this is certainly a cycle of violence. I think, when we brought you on last time, we had just sort of come off the 2021 Israel-Gaza conflict. But, you know, you've sort of drawn on a couple of points that I sort of want to, you know, extrapolate on. So, you know, those calls for a ceasefire, temporary ceasefire, we've now seen President Biden, the White House, other defense officials also call for a temporary ceasefire. A lot of folks who are protesting, though, for example, are calling for that permanent ceasefire. What are your reactions and your thoughts on a permanent ceasefire? I guess, Mr. Secretary, what do you think needs to be done before there is a permanent cessation to hostilities?
I don't think we're going to immediately have a permanent ceasefire because we can't even get a temporary ceasefire right now. So it's not likely that suddenly we're going to jump into a more permanent ceasefire, but we can get there. We could get there if we agree to have a prolonged ceasefire, 5-6 weeks, maybe a little longer, and allow the parties to be able to deal with the hostage issue and the humanitarian aid issue, let tempers cool a little bit, and determine whether or not they can take a step towards a more permanent type ceasefire. If they can agree as to where the parties are going, I think that's going to ultimately decide whether or not you can realistically achieve that ceasefire, which means that ultimately Netanyahu has to think long and hard about what is the next chapter. And I get the impression he hasn't, you know, politically he doesn't want to say what he wants to do. He wants to look like he's hard line and that, it's all about the war. But the bottom line is that he's got to think about chapter two and what that's going to look like. And what's going to happen with Gaza, and what's going to happen with the idea of a Palestinian state, and what kind of leadership can be brought together. And ultimately, I'll tell you another piece of that is that, you know, if Saudi Arabia could ultimately be brought into the Abraham Accords and try to resurrect the hope of the Abraham Accords, which right now are a little shaky, but if you could have the UAE and Jordan and others, including Saudi Arabia, become part of the Abraham Accords, recognize Israel, but also become much more involved in trying to establish the right kind of leadership for the Palestinian governing body, whatever that looks like. I think that if people could work on that and focus on that, that ultimately that would be the key, not only to a permanent ceasefire, but it would be the key to what I think is ultimately the only way to find peace in that region.
So we've seen, you know, in recent weeks, a ton of protests. Many are calling on the Biden administration to take a tougher stance on Israel to prevent further civilian casualties. The president is now using the 30,000 dead number in interviews. Many of those 30,000 dead are innocent men, women, and children. And a lot of young people are very highly critical of the Biden administration, believing that the president is not applying enough pressure on Prime Minister Netanyahu. And we're starting to see this sort of happen politically, for example, in the Michigan primary and other primaries. Do you think the president is doing enough? Does the U.S., I mean, I feel like the U.S. definitely has leverage on Israel. Why doesn't it seem like, in the eyes of many, that the U.S., that President Biden is not using this leverage on Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israeli government?
Well, I really think that the president is trying very hard to be able to use what leverage we have right now to try to get Israel to agree to the ceasefire and agree to allowing humanitarian aid to come in, et cetera. The one issue that's hanging out there is in providing military arms to Israel, which has been critical to giving Israel the weapons that it needs in order to be able to go after Hamas. if the decision is made to just go into Rafah and blow up that area and just have additional casualties among innocent men, women, and children, then I think it really is, the next step is really to put conditions on military aid that it cannot be used for that purpose. And that's a possibility. But I think what the president is hoping to do now is a combination of things. Number one, to keep the pressure on for a temporary ceasefire, to be able to get that in place. Secondly, to go ahead and provide humanitarian aid, regardless of whether there's a ceasefire or not, to have these airdrops, to have a pier that allows for ships to come in and provide larger amounts of humanitarian aid. In other words, to basically bypass kind of Israel's obstinance to agree to some kind of ceasefire by saying, if you're not going to recognize the damage that's been done to innocent people, we are, and we're going to provide assistance. We're going to provide humanitarian aid. I think that would be important to do. And thirdly, I think that the United States ought to be convening an effort to try to envision what a Palestinian state would look like, how it would be governed, and how we would provide security. That process needs to start now, not later. So I think if the president were to proceed on some of those steps, I think that would lower the temperature with regards to people that are concerned about what's happening there and protesting, obviously, their concerns, either politically or otherwise. So the president has to kind of stand back, because I think to some extent what's happened here is the president was hoping that Israel would ultimately, you know, once Hamas or the leadership of Hamas is pretty much targeted and the war begins to come to an end in Gaza, that ultimately Israel would provide the leadership to be able to take us down some of these roads. I think right now that I think Biden is concerned that Netanyahu might not go down that road. And so as a result is trying to fill the vacuum in terms of providing the necessary leadership for what is the next chapter.
So, sir, this next question will heavily rely on your experiences as CIA director, because as CIA director, you gave the president, you know, much information that the general public would not know, right? That is crucial to a lot of that decision-making power and how those decisions are made. You also serve as chief of staff, which gives you a keen insight into how presidents think. And you also served with President Biden, then Vice President Biden, the Obama administration. So, you know, when we're talking about these issues, when we're talking about like something like this Israel-Gaza war, a lot of these very contentious, hot issues, how do presidents consider these decisions? Because I think, you know, whether President Biden is making a big effort or not, right, the general public may not be understanding that as clearly as perhaps his staff, his cabinet, himself may think so. So, I mean, how does the president think about these key national security decisions when there are so many geopolitical actors involved? When, I mean, we're dealing with this, I mean, powder keg of a region, to be honest. I mean, there are so many different decisions, so many missteps that can occur that could just ignite a broader regional war. So I'd love to get sort of your insights on that, having worked with three presidents.
Well, Andre, the best way to kind of approach that is to kind of provide the guidance that I would provide as a former chief of staff as to, what would be the best path for the president to follow. And then ultimately talk a little bit about how the real war works and how presidents make those decisions. But I have to begin by saying this is a very dangerous world right now. I know we're focused on the Middle East, but it's a dangerous world. Probably more flashpoints in the world today than I've seen since World War II. It isn't, obviously, the Middle East and what's happening there is one war. The other war is Putin and Ukraine, what happens there. The third possible war is Xi and Taiwan, and what could happen there. The fourth possible war is Kim Jong-un, who's got a lot of nuclear weapons now and missile capabilities, and is threatening pretty much to wipe out South Korea. The other flashpoint is Iran, which continues to destabilize the Middle East and other areas for that matter by supporting terrorists and by supporting proxy forces in different parts of the world. And then add to that kind of the concern about technological war, particularly cyber war, and what could happen as a result of that. So there's a lot of challenges in today's world. I think it's important for a president to be able to look at that range of problems that are out there, because it all relates to our national security, and begin to put in place, you know, what are the steps that need to be taken as you address each of these flashpoints? What's the best way to deal with that? I mean, obviously, we need to have a strong national defense. We're the strongest military on the face of the earth. We need to protect that. We need to have strong diplomacy. We need to have a strong economy. But having said that, we also need to build strong alliances to help us with each of those flashpoints. And so it is incredibly important that, you know, the model of the United States and NATO working together, being unified in trying to provide help to Ukraine and stopping Putin is a good example of what we're going to have to do. Frankly, even in the Middle East, you're going to have to build alliances with moderate Arab countries, with Israel, to try to deal with both Iran and terrorism. We're going to have to build a strong alliance in the Pacific, which we have in part with South Korea, Japan, Australia, India, the ASEAN countries. I think building those alliances would be very important to deal with a lot of these flashpoints I just talked about, and that presidents need to work on that. Okay, so that's kind of the big picture analysis. How do presidents ultimately face each of these issues? I mean, in some way, a lot of it is crisis management. That, you know, you don't suddenly expect, when you're having a war in Ukraine and you're trying to provide help to your Ukraine to deal with Putin, that suddenly another war is going to break out in the Middle East between Hamas and Israel. But then it's important, you can't just walk away from that. You've got to deal with that crisis. And so a president has to look at the Middle East, obviously the horrendous attack that took place. We do have long bonds of relationships with Israel that go back to 1948, right, when Israel was established. And we do have a special relationship with them, and that's why I think the president said, you know, we understand Israel has to defend themselves from what happened, and we will do everything we can to try to assist in that effort. At the same time, you've got to look at the consequences of the action you take. So you can't be blindsided to the fact that if you go to war, if Israel goes to war in Gaza, that there are a lot of innocent people that could be killed as a result of that war. And I think you have to ask yourself, how do we make sure that we don't wind up with 25 or 30,000 getting killed in that war, innocent people? And you would hope that you would be able to discuss those consequences and what steps need to be taken in order to prevent those consequences from taking place. But when you're in the middle of a crisis and when you're dealing with crisis on a day-to-day basis, too often in the White House and at the Pentagon for that matter, you're trying to figure out what the hell is going to happen that day and what are the steps you're going to take that day. And there's sometimes too little attention to what can happen in the next few days and in the next few months and in the next year in that area, because you're involved with a crisis. You want to make sure you deal with that crisis. And that's what the focus is on. So, and I've seen this in other White Houses. This is not just the Biden White House. That in many ways, you're consumed by the crisis. And you're so consumed by it that you're not thinking about the broader strategy for ultimately how you deal with that and how you prevent that kind of crisis from happening again. And I think I understand that mentality. I've been there. You know, you wake up in the morning, you're not worried about, you know, whether there's going to be a Palestinian state. You wake up and you worry about, you know, what's the battle today? How many bombs are going to drop today? You know, where is the military strategy going today? You know, what's taking place? So you focus on the here and now. And I think because of that, you then get kind of consumed by the here and now and don't spend enough time trying to sit back and say, wait a minute, where do we want to go? Where do we want this war to go? And ultimately, how do we resolve that war? Rather than standing back and saying, you know, war is hell, and you're never quite sure what to do. There's a lot of truth to that. But at the same time, you can have an impact on the direction of that war that you have to think about. Where do you want to wind up? And sometimes you just, you know, rather than kind of trying to make this wind up in the right place, you kind of take what's happening at the moment and allow that to kind of play out. And what that does is it buys you time, but at the same time, it really diverts you from thinking long and hard about where it's all going. So, I mean, the best way to answer your question, very frankly, is that, you know, and I wish the American people could see this. Most White Houses that I've been involved with are consumed by crisis. It's the headline of the moment. It's the politics of the moment.
Yeah.
And so you deal with that and you don't really kind of focus on what are the tough steps you have to take now in order to make sure that ultimately we can achieve a goal here that provides greater peace in the area.
Absolutely. And those are very valuable insights. You mentioned a couple of flashpoint issues, one in particular, the war in Ukraine. What concerns you the most about the ongoing war in Ukraine? Is the outlook today more pessimistic than it was a year ago? And are you pessimistic, Mr. Secretary?
Well, you know, I by nature, I try to be optimistic because otherwise we'd all jump into the Potomac. But I remain optimistic here. Why? Because I don't think there is any way that the United States and our NATO allies can allow Putin to succeed. If Putin succeeds in Ukraine, that would send a terrible message to the world about our leadership and our direction. It would send a terrible message to Xi with regards to Taiwan. It would send a terrible message to all of our adversaries in the world. So that's unacceptable. It's unacceptable. We cannot allow Putin to succeed in taking over Ukraine. We can't. And so with that as a premise, I think then what needs to be done is that we have got to push the Congress of the United States to agree to this supplemental package of assistance to give the Ukrainians what they need in order to regain the initiative. I mean, right now, this thing is, you know, at best stalemated, at worst giving Russia an advantage. And we can't allow that. We can't allow that to happen. Because, you know, frankly, in my book, anytime you have a stalemated conflict, you're losing it. Whether you like it or not, you're losing it. So I think we've got to get beyond that. I'm glad that the president agreed to $300 million in immediate assistance of weapons to Ukraine. That's critical to do because we're in this vacuum, this political vacuum right now. But ultimately, we've got to get agreement on that supplemental to provide the additional aid. If we do that, I'm convinced that Ukraine is strong enough and courageous enough to be able to ultimately regain the initiative. And if they can regain the initiative, I think that that sends a signal to Putin that he's going to lose. And the only way for him to get anything out of this is to negotiate some kind of approach that is acceptable to the Ukrainians and acceptable to Putin.
So what's your reaction to the death of Alexei Navalny? He just passed away recently while imprisoned. And it seems like Vladimir Putin is stronger than ever. I mean, it doesn't seem like the Prigozhin coup that occurred, I think maybe sometime last year, really dented his power at the end of the day. It seems like he's really strong. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, you know, look, I think it's as we stand back and look at the world, that dangerous world I talked about, it really is this test between autocracy and democracy. And my sense is that autocracies like Xi in China and Putin in Russia, and for that matter, Kim Jong-un and others, have sensed weakness on the part of the United States and our allies. And have tried to take advantage of that. And so what concerns me is that Putin felt empowered enough that he could literally invade another country militarily and not think that he was going to suffer any consequences. That's a little frightening. Why did he feel that? Because I think in many ways, no one ever stopped him. When he went into Crimea, he didn't pay a price. He went into Ukraine or to Georgia, didn't pay a price. Went into Syria, didn't pay a price. Conducted a bold cyber attack against this country and really didn't pay a price for what he was doing. Saw what happened in Afghanistan, and I think he sensed weakness. And I think he's been empowered. And I do think that it was important for the United States and NATO to draw that line, to make clear that he would pay a price. And he did, I mean, largely because of courageous and brave fighters, Ukrainian fighters, who stopped an invasion of their country and pushed the Russians back. And I really think that, you know, his low point was when those military forces that he created almost took him down as head of Russia. It almost resulted in his loss of power in Russia. He got past that. How did he get past it? By killing people. That's Putin. He kills people who are his opposition. Goes back. You know, to his days, you know, as a spy and involved in intelligence. He's always been somebody who didn't hesitate to kill people who opposed him. And he continued to do that. And that's what Navalny is all about. It's killing somebody who poses a threat to you. And he's killing others, even as we speak. But it also, I think when he's operating the way he is undermining his own position with his own people. What we're seeing now in Russia are groups that are beginning to stand up. The thousands who turned out for Navalny's funeral, that was gutsy, and they did it. There are groups now that are protesting the loss of husbands and brothers who got killed in the war in Ukraine, and they're protesting. And I think deep down that the Russians know that Putin is only going to lead them into more war in the future, because that's his nature. And I think ultimately he'll pay a price for that. I think ultimately it will cost him his power. But there is no question that right now he's at his most dangerous. He continues to believe that our democracy is weak, the United States is weak, and that he can take advantage of it. So he's gonna continue to conduct this war in Ukraine. No matter what price he has to pay in terms of dead Russian soldiers, he doesn't care. But I think the story of history is the story of autocrats who overplayed their hand. And I think that's what's happening right now to Putin.
I'd love to dwell on this topic, but I feel like we need an entire podcast episode to cover the war in Ukraine and Russia and so on. But I sort of want to move on to the most important relationship geopolitically, at least what I believe is the most important relationship, the U.S. and China. It seems like relations feel a bit calmer today. We're getting the pandas back after all, so that may be maybe a good sign. But on this Taiwan issue, a lot of folks in the defense, sphere, they're very much preparing, for a war in the Indo-Pacific, potential invasion of Taiwan. Some other experts I've spoken to don't believe that, Xi, that the government of China, the PRC, will invade Taiwan. What are your thoughts on that? Do you believe that a Chinese invasion of Taiwan is likely in the near future, or that maybe the threat is a bit overblown in the minds of, policymakers and so on?
Well, I testified to this in Washington, and I'll say it again. There are those in Washington who, are saying we shouldn't provide aid to Ukraine. And those same people talk tough about China. But let me tell you, if you're weak on Ukraine, you're going to send a message of weakness to China. And I honestly believe that Xi, after Putin marched into Ukraine, was really looking closely at what would happen there to determine what he should do on Taiwan. And I think because that invasion went badly and that Putin suffered a defeat by not taking over Ukraine in the timetable that he wanted, and the fact that the United States and our allies were unified in that effort to not only penalize Russia with sanctions, but also to provide weapons to the Ukraine and training that they needed, and also to reinforce NATO. That, as a matter of fact, Putin's probably in a weaker position today as a result of that. And she's paying attention to that. So I think a lot of what happens with China and Taiwan will depend a lot on what happens in Ukraine. If we are successful at standing up to Putin and ultimately stopping him there, then I don't think Xi is going to suddenly go charging into Taiwan. I think right now he's kind of standing back First of all, I think Xi right now is too involved in his own problems back in China to kind of think about whether or not to invade Taiwan. He's still trying to deal with an economy that's recovering from COVID, having some real problems, a lot of concerns about the way he handled COVID, a lot of concerns about China's economy in terms of housing crisis, et cetera. So there's a lot going on, and you could kind of sense it even in the last Congress that they were being very careful about how they approach that, because Xi really does want to make sure that obviously he remains in power, number one, but number two, that China doesn't reveal any of the serious problems that they're having to deal with. So the answer to your question is that I don't anticipate that Xi is suddenly going to decide to charge into Taiwan. For a number of reasons. At the same time, China, like Putin, Xi, like Putin, I think, initially sensed weakness on the part of the United States and sensed weakness on the part of others, that he really took advantage of that. When the United States walked away from the trade agreement that we had worked out with the countries in the Pacific, he sensed an opportunity to basically fill that vacuum. And he sensed weakness on the part of the United States. We suddenly got into a trade war with China. That probably hurt our relationships as well. And frankly, some of these incidents with the balloons, et cetera, probably impacted as well on the relationship. I think Xi suddenly realized, as did Biden, that ultimately this can't continue to go on, that we've got to try to at least get back to dialogue. We've got to get back to talking to one another. We've got to get back to having our military talk to one another. We can have our differences, but we still need to have communication because there are a lot of dependencies on both sides. So I feel better about where we're at right now, although obviously Congress decided to vote to get rid of TikTok, which probably didn't help. But on the other hand, that had been playing out for a while. I'm a little more hopeful right now that as long as we can continue to have a dialogue between the United States and China, I think our relationship will not be as volatile as it was a few years ago.
So, as we're sort of starting to conclude this interview, if I wasn't mistaken, during the 2020 presidential debates, I believe foreign policy issues were mentioned perhaps like only once. And that was really in the context of presidential scandal with the former guy and the current guy. Today, Israel, Gaza, the war in Ukraine, much more. That's what's really been dominating the headlines. I don't know if President Biden thought he'd be a foreign policy president. I don't think President Bush thought he would be a foreign policy and national security president. And then, we had these various world events happen. How do you see foreign policy intersecting with the 2024 elections?
Well, I don't think there's any question that foreign policy is going to be critical. Critical as an issue, critical as to who is ultimately elected president of the United States, and critical in terms of our own national security. I think the American people, even though they aren't particularly enamored by wars abroad, the reality is that the American people care about protecting our country and making sure that that their children and their children and their children are secure, and that we are protecting their future. And there is no question that how we approach foreign policy and how we approach all of these danger points in the world is going to be a major responsibility for the next president of the United States. Joe Biden had foreign policy experience. He knows the world. He knows the players in the world. He knows the issues that we're confronting now. He brings a tremendous amount of experience to foreign policy. But most importantly, he believes the United States ought to be a world leader. And I agree with him. I mean, look, I think the United States has to be a world leader. If the United States is not leading the world, nobody else will. Nobody else will. That's a reality. On the other hand, Trump has made clear that his principal goal is isolationism, that he wants to withdraw from the rest of the world. I mean, how a president of the United States can stand up and say that, you know, if our NATO countries are not meeting their 2% requirement, he invites Putin to basically invade these countries, and the United States will somehow not play any role. That, I mean, imagine a president of the United States inviting a tyrant to invade these other countries, and the United States is not going to do anything. I mean, I knew we were in trouble with Trump when he stood next to Putin at Helsinki and said openly, he said he trusted Russian intelligence more than he trusted United States intelligence with regards to the interference in our elections. Here's a president of the United States next to our principal adversary. I mean, Putin has only one goal that he has worked on all of his life, and that is to undermine and weaken the United States of America. And now suddenly there's a president of the United States standing next to him saying Russian intelligence is better than United States intelligence. I mean, that comes very close to betraying our own country with those remarks. So, you know, I don't think there's any question that in this election, America has to make a decision about whether we're going to remain strong, whether we're going to be a world leader, whether we're going to protect this country from all of the dangers that are out there from tyrants like Putin and Xi and the Supreme Leader and Kim Jong-un, or whether we're going to kind of walk away from that and put our head in the sand. We tried that before World War II. There were a lot of isolationists in this country before World War II that didn't want this country to get involved in a war in Europe with fascism and with Hitler. We ultimately realized that we could not escape the threat that represented to our security. And that's what led us into World War II. So we've learned that lesson once before. I don't think we have to learn it again. I think the decision has to be that the United States, the next president of the United States, has to be a world leader and has to be concerned about how we protect peace in the world.
And my last question, especially for the young folks who feel a bit disenchanted by the presidential candidates, by the war in Gaza, by sort of foreign policy, national security overall, I guess, what are your remarks to those young professionals who have been, I think, more disenchanted than before, you know, in the year 2024?
Well, that's what, you know, at our institute here, the Panetta Institute, our goal is to try to inspire young people to lives of public service. And so I deal with a number of students from the CSU system plus other universities here in California. And I know that young people are concerned about the dysfunction in Washington. They're concerned about what they see happening with politics. They're concerned about what they see happening with issues. And what I tell them is that the story of our democracy is the story of new generations of leaders that have to assume their responsibility. And very frankly, young people have to know that if they are concerned about the nature of our democracy, they are the ones that are going to have to provide the leadership necessary to restore strength to our democracy. They're going to inherit the United States of America. Very frankly, I think we need a new generation of leaders in both parties right now in this country. And they represent that hope for the future. And they also have to recognize that even recognizing the legitimate concerns they have, that they have a duty to this country, a duty to assume the responsibility of being a part of our democracy. The Constitution begins with the words, "We the people," in order to establish a more perfect union. We the people. We the people are the ultimate check in a democracy. You know, we would hope that leadership would step up to that. But let me tell you something. If leadership doesn't step up and deal with these issues, then we have an obligation to elect new leadership. That's what democracy is about. That's what the strength of our country is all about. And they have a responsibility to be part of that check and balance of we the people. And if they do that, they can make a difference. They can make a difference. I've spent my life in public service. The greatest reward in public service is whether or not you can improve the lives of others. It's not about money. It's not about a name on the door. It certainly isn't about power. It's about whether you can improve the lives of your fellow citizens. And I think if young people understand their responsibility, understand that they have to be able to live the American dream. I live the American dream. We want our children to live the American dream. If they want to make certain that they are a generation that can embrace the American dream, then they have to be part and parcel of the generation that governs our country in the future.
Secretary Panetta, thank you so much for joining me here today. For our general audience, he has a great biography, I think published back maybe about 10 years ago now, called Worthy Fights. I call it one of the best, you know, political biographies and national security biographies you'll read. So please go check that out. But Mr. Secretary, you know, thank you so much for joining me here today, for covering all these extensive topics and for going a little bit over time. You know, I really appreciate your time, as always.
Andre, it's good to talk with you. My best to all of your listeners.